This really reverses a recent trend where we've seen slower growth in manufacturing, and is good news as far as manufacturers are concerned. We had 14 of 18 industries reporting growth during the month of October.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Jacob Goldstein. Today's Tuesday, November 2nd, and that was Norbert Ohr, chair of the ISM Manufacturing Survey you heard at the top. On today's show, we're going to step back and take a big picture look at something that affects everything from how often people go out to eat to whether cities can afford to pay school teachers.
And by the way, that thing also wrecked global financial markets a few years back and may be the very thing that will bring those markets back to health. But first, of course, the Planet Money Indicator. Let's call in our Planet Money Indicator specialist. Oh, wait, you're co-hosting the podcast, Jacob Julius Goldstein. Take it away.
Today's Planet Money Indicator... a lot. It could be $500 billion, could be $1 trillion, could be $100 billion here, $100 billion a few months down the road. We won't know until tomorrow. That's when the Federal Reserve puts out its big policy statement. But the broad outlines are pretty clear. The Fed's about to create a lot of money out of thin air, and it's going to use that money to buy long-term treasury bonds. The basic idea is to drive down interest rates, which is supposed to get people to invest money, and it's supposed to get businesses to borrow more money and ultimately hire more people.
So we live in this crazy time when these numbers like $100 billion or $1 trillion get thrown around, and it's not even like, oh my God, anymore. It's like, all right, okay, it's the Fed's next trillion-dollar program. But this thing that the Fed's going to announce tomorrow, we've talked about it a little bit on the podcast. It is a huge, big deal. It is an experiment. It is probably, I would guess, the most expensive financial experiment in human history. Does that...
They've tried this thing one time before, so maybe it's the second most expensive experiment. But the first time they tried it was just in the past few years. So we don't even know yet how that experiment has played out. And they're already rolling out experiment number two.
Right. And this is the thing called quantitative easing. Alex and I did a radio story on Morning Edition about it a few weeks ago. And we are, I got to say, whether it works or not, this is an exciting thing for Planet Money because it's such a massive, complicated, fascinating financial idea that is going to affect every part of our economy. We're going to follow it very closely over the coming months and years.
But enough about the indicator, Adam. Let's get on with it.
Let's get on with the show. Okay. So we've been covering the housing market a lot, and primarily in the form of you, Jacob Goldstein, coming on with the indicator about how few homes were sold last month or what the backlog of homes are in the market. Basically, you come on every month and you use housing numbers to depress all of us.
And rightly so.
And rightly so.
You're walking around blithely optimistic saying, oh, I don't own a house. I'm totally out of this. No, you're not. I mean, look, housing is a huge deal, whether you have a house or not. It led us into the crisis. We're not going to fully be back to normal until housing is back to normal.
So what we realized is we needed, and we felt our listeners need, just a broad overview. Where are we in this housing crisis? What chapter are we in? What's the future going to look like most likely? And the guy who immediately leaped to mind is a guy who studies the deep details of housing finance, but also for his job needs to apply those to a broader view of where the economy is going overall. That's Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics.
We had this very big picture conversation with Mark, but we started out with the basics. Where are we right now in the whole arc of the housing crisis?
Well, the peak was nearly 5 years ago, so we've been sliding for 5 years. My sense is we've got another year to go, house prices will continue to weaken through this time next year.
And how do you come up with that? You know, I wonder, I read these things. Why not 6 months or why not 2 years?
Well, yeah, you're right. Good point. It's my guesstimate. The key statistic with respect to house prices is the share of home sales that are distressed, that are foreclosure and short sales. And just doing some accounting, some math, it seems to me that it's going to take about a year to work largely through that mountain of foreclosure.
And why are foreclosures so much more important in understanding this than just regular old housing sales?
Because foreclosed property and properties that are sold in a short sale are usually sold at a big discount to the market. In the current period, it's about 30-35% on a foreclosed property. So, and because there are so many properties in the market that are foreclosure sales, that drives down measured house prices and also drives down prices in the non-distressed market because the foreclosed properties are competition.
And a couple quick definition things. Short sale, explain what that is.
A short sale is where a homeowner sells their home for a price that's less than the mortgage debt they owe on their home. And the bank, the mortgage owner, agrees to this. They realize that there's no way this homeowner is going to be able to make good on their mortgage, so they're willing to allow the property to be sold at a lower price than the mortgage amount that's due.
So it has the same impact in the market. These are homes being sold at steep discounts because a bank somewhere gave up on getting the bulk of the mortgage that they had been promised. Is that?
Yeah, that's correct. And all these distressed sales have a very large impact on overall house prices. It drives down housing values.
Because obviously, if I'm like, okay, I want a two-bedroom house in Skokie, Illinois, and the non-foreclosed ones are $600,000, but the foreclosed ones are $400,000, I'm not going to pay $600,000. The guy selling for $600,000 has to come down a little bit to equal the foreclosed sales.
Exactly. And what's so key here is that foreclosure short sales make up such a large part of the market. I mean, some parts of the country, the share is 50%, two-thirds, you know, in places in Florida, Central Valley of California. So in some markets, the majority of sales are distressed.
But overall, how much of
Close to a third of home sales currently are distressed. They're either foreclosure sales or they are short sales.
Wow. That's totally unprecedented, I have to assume, by many degrees, right?
Yeah. I mean, the only period that might even come close would be in the early 1930s in the teeth of the Depression. But, of course, we don't have very good data. But if there was another point in time, it would be then.
Now, Planet Money comes out of New York, which is a huge hindrance in covering housing because –
right.
Nobody on the Planet Money team owns their home because we live in New York. And
right.
This all seems like some fictitious thing out there that people actually own homes. How does this affect those people in the economy who are not in any way thinking of buying or selling a home? Explain why housing is so important in understanding where the overall economy is right now.
Well, most people do own their own home. Almost two-thirds of the population own their own home. And when house prices are falling, nothing really works all that well in our economy. Those people who own a home are a lot less wealthy as a result, and that affects their willingness and ability to go out and spend. And that, of course, goes to the broader health of the economy. So I'm a homeowner. If my house falls in value, I may be less interested in going out to a restaurant.
Even if I have no intention of selling for another decade. I still feel that.
And I think generally people are very attuned to their net worth, much more so than any time in the past, because everyone's nest egg is so much smaller than it was, and the population is a lot older. I mean, the largest single year age group in the country is 50. So if you're 50 years old and you're now worth a lot less, and on top of that, you're not so sure about holding on to your job until you're 65. And on top of that, you're worried about Social Security and your medical care and everything else. You're going to be very, very attuned to your net worth. And if your net worth changes a little bit, you're going to change your behavior a lot. Well, the other link between the house prices and the broader economy that affects everyone, including renters, is it affects financial institutions. Most small business people, when they want to get a loan, have to put up their home as collateral. And if your home is falling in value, no bank is going to give you a loan. And if you can't get a loan, you're not going to hire. And if you're not going to hire, then everyone's got a problem. And so the weakening in housing values is everyone's problem.
So just to think it through, so housing prices are falling. So people directly can't take out equity lines of credit against their home, or they just feel poorer. They're more worried about their retirement. They're more worried about the future. But the end result is the same. They're not buying things they don't have to buy. They're buying fewer TV sets and SUVs or whatever it is, consumer goods. They're not going out to eat at restaurants. Right. And as a result, those companies are not hiring as many people. They're not ordering as much stuff from factories who aren't hiring as many people, et cetera, right? That's one,
exactly.
One connection. Another right. connection is that because housing prices have fallen and housing is one of the bedrock elements for credit in our society, both for personal credit, for small business credit, but also the big banks, because the overall value of housing has fallen, there's less credit available. And so whether it's going out and spending more money on your credit card or creating a new small business that's going to employ more people, or if it's a bank giving big loans to some factory to expand and hire more people, credit is tied up in these fallen housing prices. Less credit means less business, means less employment. So there's two different channels that are really hurting the economy.
Beautifully said. I mean, I'll give you a third. Many local governments, and local governments are the largest employer in our country, rely on property taxes. That's their main source of revenue. So if house prices and commercial real estate values are falling, and both are, that undermines their tax revenue base. They have less money to employ people, to fund programs, to pave roads. And in many cases, they fall so short that they're looking for other revenue sources. All of that also is a very, very significant weight on our economy. Just take a look at the recent jobs data. The part of the economy that's losing the most jobs right now are state and primarily local government, and a lot of it goes back to the housing bust.
And that means firing a lot of teachers, for example, firing road crews that might be improving roads, which makes me think we'll be paying the cost of this for decades to come, with less educated people, with lousier roads that we'll have to fix at greater cost, all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Police, fire, EMT, all those services that many of us rely on. I mean, they're critical kind of jobs. We're losing them because of the collapse in the housing market. Yeah.
So if we're in this sort of cycle now where home prices have fallen and all of these different channels in the economy are negatively affected as a result, I mean, that seems like this feedback loop that is hard to get out of. How does this end? How do we get out of this?
Well, I do think policymakers deserve a lot of credit for breaking what was a very vicious collapse in the housing market. In 2008, it was literally straight down into early 2009. And the various policy efforts were very instrumental in breaking that self-reinforcing negative loop, and housing market it's not improved, but it has stabilized.
And I would like to talk about some of the things the policymakers did. Can we start with the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank? I mean, mm-hmm. I think people have been thinking a lot more about the Fed lately than they normally do. We've been hearing a lot more about the Fed lately, but I think we generally think of Fed as controlling interest rates and controlling the money supply. What do they have to do with housing?
Well, they're playing a key role in keeping mortgage rates at record low levels. Most people now get a fixed mortgage. The fixed mortgage rate as of last week was 4.23%. That's 4.23%. And that's about as low as it's ever been. And that is due to a number of things. But the key factor is what the Federal Reserve has done and what financial markets anticipate that it will do over the course of the next 6 months.
And we did a podcast recently. The Fed did something it had never done before. It spent $1.25 trillion directly buying mortgages, basically mortgage-backed securities, from the market. So that's a direct intervention in the mortgage market. Can you explain the effect of that?
Yes. So in the first round of what we might call quantitative or in some cases credit easing, the Federal Reserve bought Treasury securities, but mostly it bought mortgage securities. So it was working directly to bring down mortgage rates, fixed mortgage rate.
But how does buying an existing mortgage help the next guy get a cheaper mortgage?
Well, investors buy the mortgage loans essentially through these securities. And if the Federal Reserve is in there buying these securities, it's like an investor, and they're willing to pay up for it, then that drives down the interest rate that you and I as potential home buyers will have to pay. So they're essentially lending us the money at this very low interest rate. The Federal Reserve is directly lending to home buyers through the securities market.
Which is crazy, right? I mean, that's just not something the Fed has ever even thought about doing before.
No, it's completely outside the box. It's worked, though. I mean, it has brought down mortgage rates. As I said, there are record lows.
I don't mean it's now, crazy judgmentally. Just mean it's unusual.
Yeah. It's really crazy. I mean, it's really amazing what they've done.
So now the Fed is buying 10-year U.S. government treasury bonds. Oh, we believe they're going to start very soon. That's not directly buying mortgages, but from what I understand, banks often tie their mortgage rates to those long-term treasury bonds. So it has the same effect of getting banks to offer people cheaper mortgages than they would otherwise. Is that
yes,
right?
That's right. So now they're going to – or they've clearly signaled they're going to engage in an effort to buy a lot of long-term treasury securities. And fixed mortgage rates are very closely tied to 10-year treasury yields. And if you bring down 10-year treasury yields, because the Fed's going to be buying a lot of those treasury securities, you'll bring down fixed mortgage rates. And, markets are already anticipating this, and that's why fixed mortgage rates are at record lows. The markets fully expect the Fed to step up and buy these treasury securities.
So you talked a little bit about the policy response. As part of this whole thing, the government took Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship, and it greatly expanded loans that are guaranteed by the FHA, basically mortgages where the government is insuring that if people don't pay off, the government will make good on it. So what does all that mean for the extent to which we're on the hook? What does all that mean for how much taxpayers are on the hook, say, if the housing market goes down sharply again?
Well, Fannie and Freddie are going to cost us a bundle. I mean, of all of the policy efforts, stimulus, TARP, bailouts, everything you can think of, Fannie and Freddie are going to be the most costly of this. My sense is that it'll probably cost us somewhere around $175 billion, the two of them together, when it's all said and done. This is still a script being written, but I think that's a reasonable estimate. The other efforts, what the Federal Reserve has done, what the FHA is doing, the housing tax credits, the loan modification efforts, the efforts to facilitate mortgage refinancing, I can go on and on and on. The cost of that will be relatively small. In totem, I think we're talking, 20, 30 billion. I mean, that's a lot of money. I don't mean to say that it's not. But in the grand scheme of the things that we did in this crisis, that's a relatively small amount of money.
Right. That's in the 0.1% of GDP. Now, all of this brings up a question people ask me, relatives and friends quite often, which is, wait a second. We had a crisis brought about by way too many people getting home loans that they shouldn't have qualified for. And we're getting out of this crisis by the Federal Reserve and the government spending trillions of dollars so that people who couldn't otherwise afford homes can afford homes. There is something counterintuitive about that.
Well, what the Federal Reserve and the government are doing is trying to ease the process of digesting all those bad loans that we made to bring down interest rates, allow people to refinance, bring down their mortgage rates so that they can reduce their debt payments, to ease this process. And it does help to support demand for homes and for cars and people who use their credit card for lots of different things with these low interest rates. But that's the idea. I mean, that's how we get out of every recession. That's exactly what we do. We lower interest rates. It's just that in this particular Great Recession, the situation has been so dire that the Federal Reserve has had to resort to even more aggressive tactics to try to help do what they always do in recessions.
So can we go through into the future? So just walk us through like a reasonable scenario, what you're predicting. So you said a year housing prices start stabilizing and even going up. Is that right?
Yeah, I think a year from now we'll be through this largely enough through this foreclosure problem that house prices will start finding their footing. And certainly by 2012, we'll see some price growth. Yes.
So what happens then? So housing prices start rising. Well, walk us through.
Yeah, I think the next 6, 9, 12 months are going to be somewhat uncomfortable. I mean, we still have more work to do. We still have these problem loans to digest. People are still shell-shocked. I mean, it was only a year and a half ago that major U.S. companies were evaporating before our eyes. You just don't forget that very quickly. So I don't think we're going to take off anytime soon. But, you know, good things are happening. We are reducing debt. Household debt is down about $1 trillion over the last 2 years. Businesses, big companies and mid-sized companies are incredibly profitable. You know, all that job cutting, cost cutting they did is very painful, but their margins are wide, and you mix in a little bit of sales growth and you get enormous profitability. And their balance sheets are very strong. They've reduced debt. They've been able to refinance and lock in these low rates. So I think this economy is fundamentally strong. I don't think an economy can produce 6% productivity growth, which is what we did over the during the recession, if at your core something is fundamentally wrong. We messed up badly. The system that we had in place to originate loans was flawed, deeply flawed, and it cost us. It cost us wealth. It cost us 8 million jobs. It cost us a 10% unemployment rate. But I think we figured that out. We're working through those problems. And again, fundamentally, we're fine. We can't lose the sight of what makes our economy really tick, though. And that is the most educated population, the best infrastructure, and most importantly of all, that we continue to attract the best and brightest from all over the planet. Because as long as we can do that, we're going to be just fine, and we just need to get through the next 9, 12 months. And I'm very confident that we will be off and running again. The dog days are over.
The dog days are done. Wow, Jacob. I think for the first time ever, we've actually injected some optimism and happiness about the economy into a podcast.
Right. I'll resist my native impulse to see things in the worst possible light just for a minute.
In fact, just for 9 to 12 months, because in a year or so, according to Mark Zandi, everything's going to be fine again.
Kanahura.
Yeah.
All right. So you can tell us what you thought of today's podcast on Facebook at facebook.com/planetmoney.
Or on our blog, npr.org/money. Also, we really love getting emails as well at planetmoney@npr.org. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Jacob Goldstein. Thanks for listening.